Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
It's the nation's capital, it's Washington, D.C.
The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reported this week that life expectancy in the U.S. is lower now, in part because of the opioid epidemic. The crisis is often portrayed as largely affecting the white rural working class. But one of the places with the highest rates of overdose deaths is right here in Washington, D.C. Here to talk about this is Dr. Tanya Royster. She is director of Washington, D.C.'s Department of Behavioral Health. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me, Lulu.
Washington, D.C. is behind only West Virginia, Ohio, and Pennsylvania in its rate of overdose deaths. Those are very rural states, whereas D.C. is urban, it's diverse, it's doing very well economically, relatively, or at least certain parts of it are doing well. What's going on here?
We have a unique situation here in the District of Columbia that might mimic some of the rural areas. We have a chronic long-term heroin user who, with the introduction of the synthetic opioids like fentanyl into the drug supply, are having a higher death rate.
Who is being affected by this?
Our typical death from an opioid overdose is an older African-American male between the age of 40 and 60. So as you see, that's quite different than what's being described around the country.
So can you put that into context for us? Why is that particular community being affected?
Context. Well, because here in the district, we have not seen the excessive opioid prescribing and the conversion from misuse of opioid prescriptions to heroin on the street, which is the modality of addiction that has been described in other places.
So like a doctor prescribing a painkiller and then those people becoming addicted to the painkillers and then moving on to heroin.
Exactly. What we see here is our chronic user who has been using heroin for 20, 30, 40 years now being affected because of the introduction of fentanyl and other adulterants into the heroin supply.
Yeah, you know, doing some reading into this, heroin's been a big problem here in D.C. for decades. It's affected black men the most. But there really hasn't been a big focus on it by either the media or the government. What does that tell you?
Well, nationally, there hasn't been a focus. But certainly here in the district, sure, we have been focusing some people would say too much on that population.
Wow! Hey, yo, drama, hold up, sir. Hold on. Stop the motherfucking record.
All right.
I want you to Pondy replay, drama. Pondy replay.
Let's give him one more chance, man. Run that shit the fuck back.
Yeah, you know, doing some reading into this, heroin's been a big problem here in D.C. for decades. It's affected black men the most. But there really hasn't been a big focus on it by either the media or the government. What does that tell you?
Well, nationally, there hasn't been a focus, but certainly here in the district, sure, we have been focusing, some people would say, too much on that population. So I think that, you know, the way that I've described it is what's happening here is probably what's happening around the country in smaller pockets. But because 80% of the deaths have been the young white population, everybody else is focusing on their 80%. Well, our 80% here in the district is the older African-American male. So I think when the rest of the country gets around to looking at that 20%, that they're going to find a lot of different diverse populations in there.
What do you do with this population of chronic drug users that's being affected? I mean, how do you help them?
So we're reaching out and providing them information and making sure they know that treatment is available and effective. And so we're really providing them direct education about this. We call that approach harm reduction, where we'd like to keep them alive long enough to get them in treatment. We're working with emergency rooms to offer treatment right in the emergency room. If someone has an overdose and survives, that's an opportunity. We're also using peers, people who have survived and are in recovery from opioids and other addictions, that are going out and speaking really in a direct kind of raw way to current users and saying it's time to make a different choice.
Dr. Tanya Royster is the director of the Department of Behavioral Health here in Washington, D.C. Thank you so very much.
Thank you.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Thursday, December 6th. 2018, so I have been told. This is our weekly book club, Dr. Tommy J. Curry's The Man Not, Race, Class, Genre, and the Dilemmas of Black Manhood. We're picking up in chapter 3, roughly around the halfway point of the text this week. We should have maybe four or five sessions to go. In the text, hope people are getting constructive information. The audio segment that you heard this week, that was reported just a couple of days ago. NPR had multiple segments talking about the life expectancy being lower. Every time that I've heard those reports, somehow there will be an asterisk, a caveat, some little snippet that, oh yes, black males, just black males, have the lowest life expectancy of all. And the same kind of sentiment that you heard there, that that's not really a big deal. Who really cares? One less rapist, mugger in the world. Thank goodness. Pause for Bill Cosby. But I thought, especially in that segment, one of the points that Dr. Curry has made consistently in this text and when he's been on the program, removing black males from study. We've already spent enough time talking about black males. We don't want to hear any more about black males. In that segment, all the hoo-ha about the opioid epidemic, black males, biggest victims in the nation's capital, no less. And it's, we've been talking about that. We don't keep talking about that. Some folks think, you know, we spent enough time. We got squirrels to think about and other folks, other people. I mean, sit around and waste all this time. Bill Cosby running around here raping people. And we're supposed to sympathize with black males. Could have easily switched and played the segment on E.J. Bradford as well. That was the black male that was shot in the back, according to autopsy reports that were released this week. Shot in the back 3 times at a shopping mall in Alabama on Black Friday. Love the black male.
Black
we'll go ahead and get started. The Man Not, Dr. Tommy J. Curry. Context of White Supremacy. Audio segment number 1. Little Niggers. Elaine Brown's analysis of the super predator mythology. The concrete flux of anti-blackness, those material dynamics of social pressure and anti-black rage that animate policy, police state violence, and white vigilantism, are doctrinaire societal obsessions convinced of their desire for the death of black men. The plexus of white supremacism in American society is not a simple naming or practicing of animus against blacks. The lifeline, blood, and sustenance of white supremacy is the physical complacency and nigrophobia that all people in America have of the nigger, the wretched, poor black child, she who mothers them, and he who multiplies. Despite the democratic prose of equality, the reality is that addressing the social equalities as they affect black men and boys requires real structural, psychological, economic, and legal change. As Toby Jenkins remarks, the challenge reflects a societal oxymoron. Seeking to advance the status of a population that the larger society has systemically oppressed. On one hand, society espouses rhetoric of concern and desire to elevate black males, but on the other hand, society practices a policy of oppression, prejudice, and disregard. Put differently, the experience of the black man in America seems to be one in which he is called Mr., but is treated with a niggardly regard. And the result is the positioning of black males at the lower rungs of society and their experiencing underachievement in almost all aspects of life. From this oxymoronic state springs contradictory thinking about race and racism that asserts the sociological conditions, the external environmental problems in poor black urban spaces, as evidence of a more fundamental and inheritable cultural disposition toward deviance, criminality, and murder. This is the milieu from which Little B, Michael Lewis, springs. Lewis is known to most as an out-of-control thug who killed a man at 13. In 1997, he was arrested for killing Daryl Woods in front of his two children and wife. While many activists continue to maintain Lewis's innocence, the issue in which this work is particularly interested is more about the stereotypes of black men and the black community used to justify the wrath of the state and public sentiment used to convict Lewis. The sexualized racist narrative surrounding Little B adamantly asserted that he killed Woods to prove his toughness, his manhood. Because Lewis was a black boy, his journey to manhood was dictated by fulfilling his savage instinct to kill. In the mind of the public, Little B's childhood, the life of a black boy, represented the evilness of black manhood made manifest. There was no exemption from the public. There was no sympathy for him as a child, because ultimately, he was not a child or even a human. At his core, he was a nigger. Little B was the result of the pathology of the nigger let loose. The warning white America has heralded since slavery: if you give these blacks freedom, they will turn into beasts. Little B was the symbolic proof to the white imagination that a nigger, even a nigger child, must be ruled. Commenting on the repetitiveness of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution's describing Little B, a child, as evil, Elaine Brown realized that the term was meant to express a phobia, some sort of primal fear of the beast within, as though Little B were a mythical wolf boy. An editorial in that newspaper argued that Little B was a young killer and that many of these young killers are living outside the bounds of normal social interaction, tiny thugs who kill at the slightest insult or sometimes without any provocation. But the Atlanta Journal-Constitution simply reproduced the decades-long symbolism that marries young black males to criminals. Melissa Harris Barlow's monumental study, Race and the Problem of Crime in Time and Newsweek cover stories, 1946 to 1995, argues that crime began to be racialized in the current form in the 1960s when criminals began to be equated with young black males. As a reaction to the push from the black community for civil and political rights, a national campaign was launched by a cover story in Newsweek in March 1965 that sought to make crime generally synonymous with black men specifically. the ideological work done to solidify the connection between crime and the young black male in the mid-1960s defined the discourse about race for decades to come and marked an important dimension of the shift from traditional to modern symbolic racism. This modern racism fixated on the criminality of the young black male, facilitated the public consent for the extreme levels of coercive control applied to a substantial proportion of the African American population. It is here that we see the levels of violence that spelled death and ruin for blacks in America being justified as sanctions against black communities in an effort to control both the deviant impulse and the birth of young black males. The ideology that started as a reaction to the political and economic mobilization quickly became a core belief of American society, eventually seeking to be validated by various conjectures in the social sciences. In 1995, John DiIulio coined the term super predator to describe the burgeoning crime wave due to young black males. In The Coming of the Super Predators, he argued that a crime wave was coming and that, while the trouble will be greatest in black inner city neighborhoods, other places are also certain to have burgeoning youth crime problems that will spill over into upscale central city districts, inner ring suburbs, and even the rural heartland. DiIulio meshed the myths of scientific racism with a post-civil rights America focused on culture and environment to persuade a 20th century American public that this was really not about race, but about the cultural failures and moral poverty of poor urban communities. According to DiIulio, moral poverty is the poverty of being without loving, capable, responsible adults who teach you right from wrong. It is the poverty of being without parents and other authorities who habituate you to feel joy at others' joy, pain at others' pain, happiness when you do right, remorse when you do wrong. At the extremity of moral poverty, however, DiIulio presents blackness, unnamed but visible, through the imagery of a problem people identified by the raw concepts of their social condition. He says, in the extreme, moral poverty is the poverty of growing up surrounded by deviant, delinquent, and criminal adults in abusive, violence-ridden, fatherless, godless, and jobless settings. Despite attempts to pitch this theory as non-racial and scientific, DiIulio ultimately identifies his target, the young black male, and warns, not only is the number of young black criminals likely to surge, but also the black crime rate, both black on black and black on white, is increasing so that as many as half of those juvenile super predators could be young black males. DiIulio's attack on black men and boys is foundationally based in the view that all that's left of the black community in some pockets of urban America is deviant, delinquent, and criminal adults surrounded by severely abused and neglected children, virtually all of whom were born out of wedlock. Like the analysis offered by Angela Davis concerning the myth of the black rapist, these theories show how the stereotypes of black men and boys as predators are symbiotic to the racist sexual mythology concerning black women and girls, both of which pathologize the whole black community. Just as DiIulio depicts black men and boys as stone-cold predators, he depicts the black mother, and by extension, the black community, as neglectful and dangerous, since The abject moral poverty that creates super predators begins very early in life in homes where unconditional love is nowhere but unmerciful abuse is common. This theme of black pathology gets scientific language toward the end of 1996 in the book Body Count, Moral Poverty, and How to Win America's War Against Crime and Drugs, which argues that black urban spaces are best understood as criminogenic communities or places where the social forces that create predatory criminals are far more numerous than the social forces that create decent, law-abiding citizens. The problem, according to DiUlio and his co-authors, is that most inner-city children grow up surrounded by teenagers and adults who are themselves deviant, delinquent, or criminal. Although DiUlio rejected his super predator thesis years later, the language and imagery of the black super predator remains imprinted on the nation's collective psyche, as does the violent mythology of the black communities from which these black men and boys come. Internalized vulnerabilities, black male vulnerability among other blacks. While there can be no denial of the prevalence and destruction caused by white violence against black men and boys, it is not the only dynamic that threatens black male life. In black communities, black men and boys are also victims of domestic and sexual abuse at rates far higher than those of their white male counterparts. Black males are thought to be too dangerous to actually be victims of domestic and sexual violence. While conversations concerning police brutality or racism are common, albeit misunderstood, there is rarely any attention to the ways in which sexual and domestic violence affect black men in their own communities. The hyper-masculine stereotypes of black males make it almost unfathomable for many onlookers to see black men and boys as victims of women's violence or rage. And in those few instances that such conversations become somewhat possible, they are mischaracterized as an irrelevant phenomenon that ultimately deflects from the prevalence of female domestic and sexual abuse. In reality, black men and boys suffer physical and sexual abuse from men and women within their communities. This fact remains unacknowledged in current academic disciplines governed by the calculus of identity, since any centering of the black male, even when addressing his specific experiences and dynamics of trauma, are deemed to be unjustified. He is simply the wrong body, thought to be undeserving of the position as subject. Typical of the ways in which black men are overdetermined by the corpse, the dead black male body, conversations concerning abuse of black males have been erased altogether under current theorizations of black masculinity. In other words, the only oppression black males can have is the death caused by racism. Since domestic and sexual violence exceed the limits of this conceptual boundary, it is not seen. It is thought to be non-existent and irrelevant to our current understanding of black men and boys. Historically, black men have been well represented as victims of both intimate partner violence and intimate partner homicide in government reports since the 1970s. Recording intimate partner homicide, IPH, among blacks, the gender ratio was below 1 prior to the mid-1980s, as fewer black females than black males were murdered by intimate partners. By the mid-1990s, the ratio reached 1.5 black female victims for every black male. In fact, between 1976 and 1989, more black men were killed by their wives than black women were killed by their husbands. After 1990, the order was reversed and the murder rate among black wives and ex-wives was higher than that among black husbands and ex-husbands. Overall, black communities endure higher rates of intimate partner violence, IPV, than white communities, as both black men and black women are more likely to experience domestic violence than their white counterparts. Reporting for the U.S. Department of Justice, Callie Renison and Sarah Welkins observed that blacks were victimized by intimate partners at significantly higher rates than persons of any other race between 1993 and 1998. Black females experienced intimate partner violence at a rate 35% higher than that of white females and about 2.5 times the rate of women of other races. Black males experienced intimate partner violence at a rate about 62% higher than that of white males and about 2.5 times the rate of men of other races. The National Intimate Partner and Sexual Violence Survey 2010 makes a similar case for considering black men as victims of intimate partner violence. According to the report, while an estimated 40.9% of black women, or roughly 6 million black women, will experience some form of intimate partner violence in their lifetime, 36.8, or about 4.6 million black men will as well. The historical patterns of black male victimization and death are often left out of the narratives concerning the nature of domestic violence to sustain the almost exclusive focus currently held by gender theorists on women as victims and men as perpetrators. Contrary to contemporary theory, which insists on masculinity as the sole cause of domestic abuse, intimate partner violence, and intimate partner homicide in the black community, like that in the white community, is heavily correlated with the concentration of poverty in these areas. In reality, black men and women are subjected to this kind of violence. It is not simply patriarchal, as if it were perpetrated exclusively by males. Intimate partner violence is an extension of the violence found in neglected communities, which enters homes through the psychology and interpersonal relationships of men and women affected by economic, political, and various other environmental traumas. Efforts to center black male victims in discussions of intimate partner violence are often cast as erasure of the real victims of domestic abuse, women. Often, attempts to discuss the suffering of black males, whether they are husbands, boyfriends, or children, are dismissed as irrelevant to the more important issue of black women's victimization by men. Among scholars, male and female, a belief exists that if a black man is attacked by a black woman, he deserves it, or because he is male, it is his obligation to de-escalate female aggression toward him, even if it means he is physically or verbally assaulted in the process. These reactions are the outgrowth of a deeply held conviction that men are the perpetrators, not the victims, of domestic violence. In liberal arts disciplines, domestic violence is thought of almost exclusively as patriarchal violence. In fact, bell hooks has argued that the term domestic violence should be replaced with patriarchal violence because it continually reminds the listener that violence in the home is linked to sexism and sexist thinking to male domination. Often, the humanities appeal to intuitive observations and personal experience to supplement empirical study and evidence, as in the social sciences. The effect of such appeals, however, in the case of underreported or unpopular phenomena, can contribute to the further marginality and invisibility of social practices. Academic fields continue to discount the rates and consequences of domestic abuse and violence on the psychology and personhood of black males. simply because the epistemic traditions of these disciplines allow evidence to be discounted for personal experience. Under this schema, if the speaker has not seen black men or boys abused, then there is a case for suggesting black men and boys are not abused, or that they are not abused to an extent that is significant enough to warrant discussion as a social problem similar in magnitude to the abuse of women. These conversations function as an extension of disciplinary politics rather than the prevalence of intimate partner violence and intimate partner homicide throughout society. It is common for domestic violence to be used as evidence for establishing patriarchy as the political dividing line between black men and women, as well for black women's needs of feminist politics concerned with their particular vulnerability due to their race and gender. Very little discussion of race and intimate partner violence deals with the mental, economic, or environmental causes of these conflicts or the populations identified by the National Crime Victimization Survey's qualitative reports of abuse. These discourses assume that ending domestic violence against women is a matter of eliminating toxic masculinities and patriarchy instead of ameliorating the conditions in which these populations find themselves or improving their access to mental health or substance abuse treatment. Intimate partner violence and homicide and sexual violence against black men and boys offer evidence that our understanding of the oppression of black males also has an ideological dimension that is internalized not only by the larger white society, but also by members of their own racial group. These internalized vulnerabilities, so to speak, make black men potential victims of all those who engage them. Because society dehumanizes black men and boys, constructing them as invulnerable to offense, individuals recognize that there is little punishment for taking violent action against this group. Internalizing black male vulnerabilities is not about individuals simply believing stereotypes about black males. It is about how individuals are socialized to understand that society's conceptualization of black males as criminal and savage empowers anyone to act against black men and boys without fear of punishment. Internalizing the vulnerable social positions of populations, as in the case of black men, offers individuals a providential rationale for committing violence or acting against individuals from groups that society thinks of as evil in the flesh. The pervasiveness of misandric myths about black men has allowed stereotypes and antipathies to be internalized throughout society without question. Within the consciousness of individuals, internalized vulnerability exists as an almost intuitive knowledge of the fungibility of black males in society, so that the social or personal relation or contact an individual has with a black male offers a level of power over that black male body. Since black males can never be victims, other individuals, even other blacks and minorities, have the power to abuse, exploit, or rape them without fear of sanction. In other words, the dehumanization of black men and boys, generally by society, gives individuals explicit permission to dehumanize them as well. In this sense, perpetrators of violence against black males are not guilty of any crimes at all. They are simply participating in the subjugation of non-human things that have no moral status or empathy in the larger society, especially in the case of personal or intimate partner violence. Duluth No More, the ideology and politics behind the patriarchal thesis. In Education Groups for Men Who Batter, The Duluth Model, Ellen Pence and Michael Paymar, the inventors of the model, argued that treating men who batter their partners is not a neutral endeavor. In the Duluth program, each facilitator conducts a group within a community, a program, and a personal philosophical framework that either supports a man's process of change toward nonviolence or reinforces his dominance over the woman he batters. Theory guides practice, say Pence and Paymar, and their theory is simple. Men are culturally prepared for their role of master of the home, even though they must enforce the right to exercise this role. They are socialized to be dominant and women to be submissive. The Duluth model holds that men need not intend to batter women. It is an automatic, almost unconscious response, part of the programming men are taught in their families of origins and through their experiences in a culture that teaches men to dominate. Many clinicians and psychologists, however, adamantly disagree with this model. For example, Donald Dutton has argued that intervention systems like the Duluth model were focused on confronting sexist attitudes or male entitlement. The problem was that there was no evidence that batterers had sexist attitudes. In addition, Kenneth Corvo, a professor of social work, maintains, in spite of strong and consistent clinical and ideological linkages, the Duluth model views substance abuse as almost irrelevant in the perpetration of domestic violence. While gender scholars in the humanities have continued to insist that there is an intuitive link between domestic violence and patriarchy, clinicians have offered study after study demonstrating that there is little clinical or ideological evidence to support the claim that domestic abuse is solely the province of patriarchy or that men abuse because of psychological or psychoanalytic disposition toward domination. Histories of previous abuse, addiction, and mental health are so highly correlated to incidents of partner violence that it is negligent to ignore these factors in the incidence of intimate partner violence. In fact, the noted psychologist Denise Hines maintains that it is precisely these factors, previous abuse, drug and substance abuse, and mental health, that explain the almost symmetrical rates of abuse perpetrated by women against men in the general population. Perhaps the greatest irony concerning the Duluth model is that one of the founders, Ellen Pence, admitted that the weakness of the program was that it lacked clinical findings to support the theory that patriarchy was the cause of domestic abuse. In the subsequent article, Some Thoughts on Philosophy, Pence explains, although the DAIP, Domestic Abuse Intervention Programs, staff has argued against using casual explanations that require practitioners to assume a fairly universal psychological makeup among batterers, i.e., stress or anger control problems, we have developed some of our own truisms that also reduce complex social relationships to slogans. One was the notion that batterers use violence, coercion, and intimidation to control their partners. As Pence says, he does it for power. He does it for control. He does it because he can. These were advocacy jingles that, in our opinion, said just about all there was to say. Pence conveys that these jingles supplanted the need or search for evidence. By determining that the need or desire for power was the motivating force behind battering, we created a conceptual framework that, in fact, did not fit the lived experience of many of the men and women we were working with. Like those we were criticizing, we reduced our analysis to a psychological universal truism. Despite the incongruity of their theory to the lives and actual motivations of abusers, Pence and Paymar successfully established a male psychologism that would come to establish the motivation men had for abuse and define women as the sole victims of this kind of violence. According to Pence, the Duluth model was never meant to explain the actual cases or circumstances of domestic violence. It was about imposing the ideological stance of the model and its staff, and that meant ignoring violence between same-sex couples and violence committed by women against men. Cases of domestic abuse that did not fit their theory were simply dismissed as irrelevant to the ideological commitments of the Duluth Project. Pence explains, "It was the cases themselves that created the chink in each of our theoretical suits of armor. Speaking for myself, I found that many of the men I interviewed did not seem to articulate a desire for power over their partner, although I relentlessly took every opportunity to point out to men in the groups that they were so motivated and merely in denial. The fact that few men ever articulated such a desire went unnoticed by me and many of my coworkers. Eventually, we realized that we were finding what we had already predetermined to find. The DAIP staff were interpreting what men seemed to expect or feel entitled to as a desire. When we had to start explaining women's violence toward their partners, lesbian violence, and the violence of men who did not like what they were doing, we were brought back to our original, undeveloped thinking that the violence is rooted in how social relationships, for example, marriage, and the rights people feel entitled to within them are socially, not privately, constructed." Pence admits that ideology, rather than careful empirical studies, formed the philosophical foundation of the Duluth paradigm. "We all engaged in ideological practices and claimed them to be neutral observations," writes Pence. In its earliest formulation, Duluth was solely committed to the criminalization of male perpetrators, even while realizing that the criminal justice system did not effectively change the social norms that were most responsible for intimate partner violence. Pence's comments on Duluth's paradigm have had little effect on how liberal arts disciplines account for intimate partner violence and intimate partner homicide. The deliberate exclusion of violence committed by women against men and children by Pence and early gender theorists following her model has been moralized away as anti-woman or victim blaming rather than a serious challenge to how one conceptualizes violence within the home or intimate relationships. Ultimately, the validity and soundness of the theory has seemed to be irrelevant to its adoption in the humanities as an explanatory model of male aggression and black males' compensatory motivations for violence. The premises of this model have sustained decades of work and legitimized assumptions thought to explain intimate partner violence in black communities. Contrary to the dominant view of domestic abuse in the black community articulated by authors such as bell hooks and Kimberly Crenshaw, who maintain the validity of the patriarchal thesis, Duluth model, multiple social scientists, social workers, and psychologists have shown that the causes of intimate partner violence and intimate partner homicide cannot be culturally universalized to the black community. For example, Carolyn West, a noted black feminist psychologist, argues that intimate partner violence, victimization, and perpetration can involve men and women of every race, ethnicity, age, socioeconomic status, sexual orientation, and relationship status, including married, cohabitating, and dating couples. In this view, domestic violence is an outgrowth of conflict between people in which either or both can be perpetrators and victims simultaneously. This view of domestic violence is particularly sensitive to the ways that previous research has built theories and claims from the study of only white heterosexual couples and sought to universalize such findings across all groups. Because of the large number of whites reporting incidents of abuse and constituting the subjects of research, many researchers have thought it legitimate not only to generalize their findings to all groups, but also to focus primarily on the unilateral aspects of intimate partner violence. However, when one evaluates the rates of intimate partner violence among Black, Asian, Hispanic, and Indigenous men and women, few gender differences in rates of physical and psychological aggression are found. Bidirectional abuse and intimate partner violence against Black men. In sharp contrast to the white community, in Black communities, intimate partner violence was found to be exceptionally defined by bidirectionality. Various studies have found that Black cosmologies of womanhood, vulnerability of females, and violence differ greatly from those of whites. While unilateral violence occurred at higher rates among Black males and females than in the white population, in Black households, mutual violence was most frequently reported. The rate of self-reported bidirectional intimate partner violence, 61%, was 2 times that of unidirectional female-to-male partner violence, 31%, and about 6 times higher than unidirectional male-to-female partner violence, 8%. As the epidemiologist Nikki Palmetto clarifies, a bidirectional violent relationship signifies that both partners perpetrate violence in a given relationship, not necessarily within each violent episode. In Black communities, there is no fixed perpetrator or victim. Black men and women can be both simultaneously and often are. In this sense, bidirectionality signals that Black intimate partner violence is rooted in mutual victimization and violence. These patterns consequently socialize men, women, and children into cycles of mutual conflict in which perpetrators cannot be clearly marked. As the epidemiologist Raul Catino, the public health scholar Sushani Mickler, and the clinical psychologist Craig Field remark, the influence of Black ethnicity on the occurrence of bidirectional partner violence appears to be independent of education, income, employment status, drinking, alcohol problems, and history of violence in the family of origin. While we know that the aforementioned environmental stressors increase the probability of intimate partner violence, something else is operating in the Black community that particularizes intimate violence as bidirectional. A major obstacle to the recognition of Black male victims of intimate partner violence and intimate partner homicide is the stereotype that Black men, who are the intimate partners of Black women, are most responsible for their deaths. The most publicly debated example of this racist myth occurred in 2009 surrounding a speech on domestic violence by Attorney General Eric H. Holder Jr. In the speech, Holder claimed, disturbingly, intimate partner homicide is the leading cause of death for African American women ages 15 to 45. In his defense, Holder did not pull the statistic out of thin air. The claim that intimate partner homicide was the leading cause of death for Black women, and by implication that Black men made up the vast majority of perpetrators, was commonly made in peer-reviewed domestic violence literature and government reports, including the National Institute of Justice Journal, throughout the 2000s. Ultimately, however, the claimed statistic could not be verified as fact and consequently was revised and excised from several reports and publications as an error. the 2003 issue of the National Institute of Justice Journal was revised on March 11, 2014 to say homicide is a leading cause of death in the United States among young African American women aged 15 to 45 years. And the Department of Justice website now includes a disclaimer and an explanatory note to Holder's speech that reads, "These remarks, as originally delivered in 2009, cited a statistic naming intimate partner homicide as the leading cause of death for African American women ages 15 to 45. This statistic was drawn from a range of reputable sources, including a 2003 study by the National Institute of Justice. However, recent figures indicate other causes of death, including cancer and heart disease, outrank intimate partner homicide for this age group. It is one thing to point out the mistakes of peer-reviewed articles regarding misrepresentation of facts or errors of citations in government reports, but the life of this statistic concerning the implied danger black men pose to black women is a different species of concern. Holder's claim about intimate partner homicide was believable because, when it was stated as a gender proposition, it disarmed the resistance many social scientists and scholars felt toward racist stereotypes of black men as dangerous and violent, and allowed them ultimately to accept it as fact. This fantastic statistic took on a life of its own and gained fastidity based on a consensus among academics and the public that black men are, in fact, violent and thereby real threats to women in their communities. It is easily shown via a cursory examination of the Centers for Disease Control's reports that intimate partner violence simply could not be the leading cause of death of black women. Intimate partner homicide is a subset of homicides committed in a given year. From 1998 to 2013, homicide ranked second to unintentional injuries for young black women aged 15 to 24, while black women within the average age of marriage, 24 to 44, were less likely to die from homicide generally. Among black women aged 24 to 44, homicide ranged from the fourth to the seventh most likely cause of death. Thus, contrary to the idea that black men are dangerous as spouses and intimate partners, the threat of homicide as a leading cause of death diminished among black women in this age group. Black female perpetrators of domestic violence are not uncommon in the black community. This should come as no surprise, given that male victims of domestic violence are not as rare as gender theorists usually assert. Various community studies and self-reporting surveys indicate some agreement between black men and women regarding the rates of intimate partner violence perpetrated by females. We see headlines of such occurrences constantly across various media platforms, but we do not respond because we are culturally conditioned not to see or sympathize with black male victims of such abuse. On July 31, 2015, Alexis Stanton was charged with assault after pouring hot grits on a man and then beating him with a bat. On August 6, 2015, Barvetta Singletary, an aide to President Obama, shot at her boyfriend with his own gun for allegedly having an affair. Most notably, the singer Ray J was beaten by his girlfriend, Princess Love, sustaining a torn ligament, fractured ribs, and a busted lip. On September 29, 2015, Natalie Chase Robinson was arrested for throwing bleach in her boyfriend's face, covering him with alcohol, and setting him on fire. When black males are victimized by women, society, and even black academics, male and female, take the incidents to be comical. Despite the moralizations condemning domestic violence, Throughout society, there is a failure to see women as perpetrators. However, to truly address domestic violence, scholars and practitioners must come to recognize that women's violence needs to be understood as a part of the picture of domestic violence, as it may be a key aspect of more effective prevention and intervention strategies for intimate partner violence. Like his victimization at the hands of the larger white society, the black male's victimization by women is explained away by suggesting that black males are so dangerous and violent that they could not possibly be victims, or that they deserve the violence imposed on them. Case studies and statistics offering proof of black male victims of bidirectional abuse or abuse perpetrated unilaterally by females in the black community are often explained away by appealing to the obviousness of black male aggression and violence toward black women. Routinely, the revelation of black women as perpetrators of domestic violence against black men is met with the retort that women attack or kill black men in self-defense. While authors have proposed this explanation for higher rates of bidirectionality within various literatures, it has never been confirmed as true among female abusers. Not knowing the reason behind certain phenomena is not a reason for theorists to retreat into racist stereotypes about black males' violent disposition toward women. This bias among gender theorists not only erases black male suffering and death at the hands of intimate partners, but also erroneously establishes patterns of thinking suggesting that, despite the overrepresentation of African-American male victims of domestic violence and female-perpetrated homicides, males alone are responsible for intimate violence and are not themselves harmed by abuse. While nothing could be farther from the truth, when considering the actual rates of black male victims of intimate partner violence and intimate partner homicide, black masculinity theories often lack such substance regarding black males. What currently passes as theory not only ignores the prevalence of bidirectionality in the black community, but also suggests that black male victims are morally irrelevant to our understanding and condemnation of intimate partner violence. Current explanations of the role race plays in intimate partner violence systematically erase the numbers of black male victims in the mind of the theorist. Conceptualized as contradictions to the intuitive gender hierarchies established by our understanding of the masculine as perpetrating and the feminine as victimized, black male victims of intimate partner violence and intimate partner homicide are said to either not exist or not matter to the discussion at hand. This conceptualization of black males is dehumanizing because it insists that their suffering does not deserve to occupy a moment of our consideration as something real. Black males are told they can only be perpetrators of violence and remain unseen by gender theory as anything more, since their reality requires the recognition of female perpetrators. Ignoring their pain and suffering simply because they are black men or because they are abused by black women solidifies the racist regime of society in theory. These racist logics maintain that the black male can only be criminal, only danger, only threat. He cannot be human, vulnerable, or victim, especially to a black woman. Liberal arts scholars need to understand domestic violence in the black community as more than proof of a predetermined biocentric theory of black male pathology. Multiple clinicians and public health scholars have concluded that decades of research into domestic violence in the black community provides no support for a conclusion that African Americans have an inherent biological or cultural propensity for violence. Rather, the stressors and oppressive systemic forces that disproportionately affect African Americans place them at greater risk for domestic violence. As such, there is no evidentiary basis to insist that black maleness or toxic masculinity is casually related to the high incidence of domestic violence among blacks. Domestic abuse is a problem of conflict that risks the death and injury of black men, women, and children. Just as intimate partner violence perpetrated by males is associated with injury or death, so too must we confront the prevalence and danger of violence perpetrated by females. Male victims of female-perpetrated violence suffer from physical injury and disfigurement, depression, anxiety, and in some cases, death, just as their female counterparts do. Furthermore, domestic violence in the home creates a nexus of trauma that leads to concrete harm against both men and women and socializes young black boys and girls into similar patterns of intimate violence as adults. As West remarks, exposure to childhood violence in the form of being the victim of child physical abuse or witnessing domestic violence in the family of origin also has been associated with higher rates of intimate partner violence among Hispanic and African American men, women, and couples. We can no longer conceptualize intimate partner violence as perpetrated solely by males in the black community. We need theoretical frames that engage intimate partner violence bidirectionally and ecologically to better understand this phenomenon and its consequences among blacks.
Context of white supremacy. Gusty Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Thursday, December 6th, first segment of our book club, Dr. Tommy J. Curry. We get back to the second audio segment. We'll pick up on not wanted and not cared for, sexual abuse and the rape of young black boys. That'll be audio segment two. Number, if you have questions, thoughts, comments on the first audio segment, 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to join. You can drop an email as well. UntilJustice@gmail.com. UntilJustice@gmail.com. And I can read your commentary, or if you have a question that you would like to submit, we can share our thoughts as we proceed. I wrote on Facebook and I think Twitter when I was announcing the broadcast that on this week that E.J. Bradford, the autopsy, that he was shot in the back, Kareem Hunt, fired by the Kansas City Chiefs, suspended by the NFL for the conflict that he had with a white woman. In fact, I read the article on the compensatory call-in this past weekend where they said he bull rushed this white woman. How often do you hear that verb? And, of course, George H.W. Bush, President 41, they say, passed away. They had the funeral, all the pomp and circumstance. And I've said consistently, Willie Horton, that's who I'm going to talk about for the duration that they mention George H.W. I've seen many reports that have stated he would not have been president were it not for his ads on Willie Horton, the black beast, nigger, rapist, Willie Horton. But if folks see any parallels between those stories and the report that we started, which was the report that aired at the very beginning of the broadcast on the opioid abuse in the nation's capital. That was from this week as well. All four different reports right in line with the man knot, unless I am really misconstruing Dr. Curry's work. First few folks who dialed in, if you have thoughts, observations, questions, line should be open. Proceed.
Oh, can I be heard?
Yes. Yes, sir.
Yeah. How you doing, Gus? I'm just to add to also George Bush. Also the infamous Menacing Negro who sold crack cocaine right across the street from the White House. That kind of also intensified the war on black males, the war on drugs. We can add that to George Bush's legacy. Man, I had some other things I wanted to say, but I'm kind of lost right now. Let me just get my thoughts together and come back.
Oh, no. No problem if you need to take time. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
All right, greetings, Gus, and greetings to all the callers and listeners. This is Henry from Chicago. John DeLulio, I guess that's how you pronounce his name, coined the term super predator as on page 113, made actually very popular by one Hillary Clinton. I get into these debates about, you know, Hillary Clinton being a refined racist. I think she's an outright racist, if you ask me. Probably as bad as Donald Trump. Super predator. And also his commentary on this thing he calls moral poverty, you know, and I guess in this quote he says, in the extreme moral poverty is the poverty of growing up surrounded by deviant, delinquent, and criminal adults in abusive, violent-ridden, fatherless, godless, and jobless settings. And I'm pretty sure he's directing this towards black neighborhoods. But he seems to fail to understand that that this poverty is caused by the racist society that puts these black folks into these particular situations. And not very truthful in this, because he also said godless. And, you know, I'm pretty sure there's hundreds of churches in the black community, so why does he call it godless? So I didn't get that part neither. As I was listening to and reading also in regards to males being victims of domestic violence, you know, I thought about Tiger Woods and Cowbell, but Tiger Woods being married to that white woman. And I remember during the time when they were going to that divorce, she attacked him. And I remember everybody cheering her on, you know, saying, yay, yay, you go, girl. And it was just, like, ridiculous. And, you know, it's like I said, you know, I'm just – that was just, like, a very extreme case, because obviously – you know, white women, you know, are the, you know, along with white men, are the purveyors of, you know, racism, white supremacy. So, you know, nobody's going to blame them for attacking black males, because, you know, obviously in the text, you know, black males are, you know, they're not human, even somebody like Tiger Woods, who is probably the best golfer of all time. That's all I have right now. I'll mute my line.
Much obliged, sir. Others who dialed in, if you have a hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, retired firefighter.
Greetings, Gus, and everybody else that's on the broadcast. Be patient with me, please, because I don't have a book, and it's already difficult enough with a book. But from what I gather, and based on what I think some of the comments that you were making, as well as I think I don't know if it was a question or not, but anyway, I'll just say that yes, white people have used black males in their racist narrative. It's actually is an old code, very old code, in order to assist them into, from propaganda standpoint anyway, to assist them into maintaining the system of racist white supremacy, because what it does, it encourages white people to practice racism more and more, and they have a built-in narrative to say, well, it's because of those real bad Negro males is the reason why we have to keep them in their place collectively. And as victims of racist white supremacy, it definitely should motivate us to go beyond the racist narrative and really start being much more scientific in our interactions with one another to be able to solve all of these quote-unquote domestic problems that we do have that primarily has been induced by the global system of racism and white supremacy. Some of those particular type of incidents, with my career on the fire department, I've seen, and as what I think I've heard through the first reading, it hasn't always been the black male as the initiator. Some of the examples that were given, I actually, through employment experience, you know, some of them, there is a couple of young people that I coached are dead today because of their girlfriends, you know, getting stabbed in the neck. It doesn't take a whole lot of physical power to be able to kill someone, especially if you either know what you're doing or in your fit of rage, very lucky to hit a jugular vein in the neck. There was a young person that I coached a year ago that's at the University of Tennessee right now, that before he transferred over to the high school where I coached at, was stabbed in the chest by a female, by a non-white black female that was virtually a stranger, but she was having psychological problems herself. And basically, under a system of, where I factor it all in, under a system of racist white supremacy, there's going to be a lot of damage to non-white people internally because of it. Males, females, black males, black females, quote-unquote black children, which we all are under the system of racist white supremacy, it's going to be chaos, you know, in that light. And in turn, I certainly have experienced it myself as far as, I would say, for the most part, on that job that I was on. And those are my observations right now, and I will listen to other people's report on the first reading. Thank you.
much obliged, retired firefighter. Others who dialed in, if you have a hand up, proceed.
Yes, may I be heard?
Greetings, Mr. Demery Four.
Greetings. Greetings, Gus, and greetings to the other callers and listeners. One quick question before I get started concerning a passage that you read last reading. We're talking about black males in the system and that we acknowledge their position and, like aristocrats of old, express some regret for their station in life. This class bias from which black people generally, but black males particularly, are observed is saturated with condemnation, not earnestness or understanding. And so my question about that is, I wonder why he said black people generally, but black males particularly, because if you look at all of the root causes of that, which is, you know, self-hate, then it would affect the black females as well as the black males. So if someone or you or someone on the line could add some more clarity to that for me, I appreciate it. But on this reading, I was particularly interested in the young man that they call Lil B. Was Michael Lewis. I guess in 1997, he allegedly killed Darryl Woods, an older gentleman that, well, he wasn't old. He was young also, but he had a family, and it was in front of his children and wife. And then I think that I can remember this incident, and I can remember drawing a conclusion in my mind right away that, you know, this youngster should be tried as an adult. You know, so I have to admit that, you know, this same thing that Dr. Curry is writing about, how black men and boys are not afforded the opportunity, you know, to even be innocent until proven guilty. You know, because evidently there was a lot of editorials, articles, you know, concerning Lil B, you know, that was basically victimizing him, you know, making him, you know, a so-called super predator without getting the facts, you know, the entire facts of the case. And I looked into it a little bit, and I think that people like Angela Davis and a lot of activists was behind freeing this young man. And but like he was saying, it wasn't the fact of, you know, whether or not his innocence is. Elaine Brown was saying that that process, that phobia, is a kind of primal fear of the beast within. And although Lil B was treated like a mystical wolf boy, you know, so they quick to go to the worst case scenario when it comes to young black men or black men, period. And whites take this advantage to create this image or this image of other, you know, so that we would be worthy of mistreatment. So, Giuliano was talking about moral poverty. You know, he came up with the super predator, and then later on he retracted his statement. But look at all the damage that had been done and all of the people that grabbed this image, him saying that young black men were going to turn to, killers, and, you know, they're going to roam the street. At first, he didn't just say black men, but he tried to get his little image across, and then later on drew a target on young black males and said that, oh, half of them will be young black males. And then just like a lot of cases, if you go on these racist websites, I think it was Daylon Roof that mentioned he typed in black on white crimes and all this material came up. So that's what motivated him to go into the church and kill 9 people that day. So they use these, myths or pathological assumptions that they come up with to justify the victimization of black people. And like it says, the historical patterns of black male victimization and death are often left out of the narratives concerning the nature of domestic violence to sustain the almost exclusive focus currently held by gender theorists on women. I'm also wondering, I guess black feminism, had its purpose or whatever, but looking at it, they were, the black females were duped in the 20s to assist in women's suffrage, and this new black feminism, talking about intersectionality, and basically it creates a male authority figure or a male patriarch or, this black male is further throwing us under the bus, it seems like to me, unless I'm mistaken. I don't have anything against any particular group, bringing up their issues and protesting. But when it has to be at the expense of another group, I don't think that's productive. But I'll mute my line. Thanks, Gus, for taking the call.
Much obliged, Mr. Demery Four. So Mr. Demery Four did pose a question about the passage that I read last week. I guess I could read it again. We acknowledge their position, black males, and like the aristocrats of old, express some regret for their station in life. This class bias from which black people generally, but black males particularly, are observed is saturated with condemnation, not earnestness or understanding. And he wanted to know why particularly black males, why wouldn't the same apply for black females? Other folks that we've not heard from, if you have commentary, if you want to respond to the question, proceed.
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes. Greetings, Gus. Thank you again for the platform. Greetings to callers and listeners. Really, another really good passage. I did like the, and this is just off the top, I did like the fact that he brought out very big points when Eric Holder gave that speech, and he also pointed out the other points in the past with the gentleman that was the one of the actual founders of domestic abuse intervention programs, DAIP, and how each instance, when they really did the data, instead of going on their stereotypical assumptions and making these assumptions, they found that their data, their perspective was incorrect, but the damage has already been done. And there's no, when somebody gets on a platform and speaks out loudly against a certain group of people, but then after they finish saying that, the people in the audience gravitate to what that person says, and that person is incorrect. It's not like Eric Holder's coming back out on stage saying, oh, yeah, what I said a couple months ago was incorrect. You actually have to go and do the research and actually look this up yourself and find out that, wait a minute, this gentleman was completely in error when everything he was saying. And that's the thing that I find really frustrating in actually reading this. And you know, again, I tip my hat to Dr. Curry again for the diligence. Like, he really did a lot of research. Getting to the text, one of the parts that stood out. This is on page 116. It's at the bottom. The internalizing black male vulnerabilities is not about individuals simply believing stereotypes about black males. It is about how individuals are socialized to understand that society's conceptualization of black males as criminal and savage empowers anyone to act against black men and boys without fear of punishment, i.e. race soldiers, i.e. vigilantes, Zimmerman. You know, this line here speaks a very clear passage to exactly what we keep seeing day in, day out, month after month, year after year. Going into the next page, it elaborates on it a little bit more, 117 at the top. Within the consciousness of individuals, internalized vulnerability exists as an almost intuitive knowledge of fungibility. I've never heard of that word before in my life. And it seems to mean, in economics, fungibility is the property of a good or a commodity whose individual units are essentially interchangeable. So he's saying the black males have some type of fungibility, like interchangeableness, like in value to some degree, their bodies at that, because he goes on to say black males in society, so that the social or personal relation or contact an individual has with a black male offers a level of power over that black male body. Definitely great point. And numbers, again, I give him so much credit for bringing this number up, because I've never seen it. And he gives, you know, resources where you could actually find this information and look it up yourself instead of just, you know, going on what he's writing. 115 in the middle, the National Intimate Partner Sexual Violence Survey of 2010 makes a similar case for considering black men as victims of IPV. According to the report, while an estimated 40.9% of black women, or roughly 6 million black women, will experience some form of IPV in their lifetime, 36.8%, or about 4.6 million black men, will as well. And I think that is something that, I mean, I don't know if it'll work for so-called black feminists if seeing these numbers, reading some of these texts, like, because this passage is really breaks down the whole hyper-masculinity concept in various ways. I mean, the whole book does, but this brings a lot of numbers to light that I think are very foundational and very important in understanding exactly what's going on to some degree. And at least can create some kind of discussion to go, okay, maybe we were wrong. Because as far as I'm seeing, the false conception, perception of black males is creating so much divide within our families and in our so-called communities that we have to start to get to some bottom line and discussions about it. That being said, thank you again, and I will mute my line. Thank you.
Much obliged for the commentary. If other folks have comments,
can I be heard?
Thomas in New York? Yes, sir.
Good evening, guys. Good evening to all the callers. Hillary Clinton, the super predator comment. If you noticed, there was a white male who coined the phrase. But when the white woman used it, you know, it put the white males into action about doing something about it. You know, it was like the white woman who cries rape, or he was whistling at me, you know, and it sets the white men off. So when she said that, then all types of legislation came down to deal with these super predators. And she wasn't even a politician, and she was just the president's wife. But they used that white woman to do that. I think that the concept of the black male domestic abuse, I think that for black males, being that they're not allowed to become men under the system, it's ultimately emasculating and embarrassing to even admit or to conceive the notion that you're being domestically abused by a woman, you know, that is not white. You know, I think that it's a, man, I think that just that concept, it's like he said, people laugh, they make jokes about it. I mean, you know, it's almost comical to the fact that, you know, here you are, this big black male, and you're able to be, you know, abused by this little black female, you know, that is supposed to be under the system of patriarchy, lesser than the male. However, being that you're both, you know, black, you know, or classified as black, both of you are in the same boat as far as status in the system. So, very interesting concept. As for Mr. Bush, everything was closed yesterday. Post offices, banks, for a murderer. You know, just to keep it in context with the book study sessions, the father of the man who left those people on their roofs in Katrina, you know, so I always say the apple doesn't fall too far from the tree. No, it's not Saturday. And I'll mute my line. Thank you, Gus.
Much obliged. Compensatory call-in on Saturdays. Other folks, if we missed, if you have commentary to share, number 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you have comments, questions. Did anybody want to respond to Mr. Dermifor's question about why Dr. Curry thought there was something specific about the kind of disregard that we have for black males that's above and beyond black people in general?
Hey, Gus, can you read the passage one more time? I did want to respond, but I really would like for you to read it one more time if you can, if it's not too much to ask.
One more time. We acknowledge their position and, like the aristocrats of old, express some regret for their station in life. This class bias from which black people generally, but black males particularly, are observed is saturated with condemnation, not earnestness or understanding.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
I'll take a chance at it because for some reason in my mind, when I hear the statement that you read and also when you even shorten the question, that the whole idea about the negativity through speech and action with black males has to continue in order for the global system of racist white supremacy to thrive. It has to. And in my mind also, the way I'm thinking, there would be no improvement between the whatever truthful negative interactions between black males and black females until the global system of racist white supremacy is being dismantled. It'd be impossible. It's just not logical for you to have a pristine environment of non-white victims of racist white supremacy and white supremacy still being in existence at the same time. that's not even logical, you know, from that standpoint. So it has to be a major conflict. And back to what I was speaking about before, you know, with the narrative that has been going on for hundreds of years, even the name that you selected, the person who played the particular part in that famous movie that you adopted the program name for,
was a perfect example, of how, from a standpoint of propaganda wise, you know, along with Hillary Clinton and Ronald Reagan had something similar. I believe it was with a black female. This particular Bush that they putting in the ground, I guess, sometime before the end of the year. The things he came up with, it's something that they have to have, because they're not really afraid of black males, but it's the idea of showing that particular content that would keep inspiring white people to practice racism. This is the reason why you are doing this. Racist white man, racist white woman, racist white child. This is the reason why you're doing it. And they're showing an example of the damage results that they actually created themselves. You know, hopefully I'm making some sense out of that, but that's my thoughts right now. Hopefully I did some kind of insight with the question. Thank you.
Much obliged. Thomas in New York, did you want to respond? Not hearing you, or he might not be able to share. Anybody else want to respond to the question, that segment I just read?
Can I be heard? I'm sorry, I was
yes,
far away from my phone. I had to want to get it unmuted. I think that the combination of black males is definitely necessary to maintain the system. I believe that's one of the reasons why entertainment is constantly portraying an image of negativity of black males, even the news. But I'm just saying that's something that they sell worldwide. They have to have the whole world have this combination for black males.
Much obliged, Thomas in New York. I did want to add, there were a number of black males who were also tricked during the 20th century suffrage movement to get white women the right to vote. There were many black, Frederick Douglass cowbell being one of the more prominent victims of white supremacy, who was duped in that manner as well. Let's see, comments to share. To respond to Mr. Demery Ford's question about the segment I just read, I would point to a few things. One being, I think Ivy pointed this out some time ago, even just looking at maybe some flagrant things that we don't think about. Now, we've been saying black male, black male, black male. You look in the dictionary for the concept of black male, to force someone to do something, generally something that they do not want to do, something that they would not do if they were not being forced, coerced somehow, someone who has more power than they do. And they come up, we need to think of a name for that, having power to force someone to do something against their will. What name would we assign to that? Black male. Ivy said that on the program. Other folks pointed that out. I think that certainly should be thought about as we read the text. I would also go back to the very reason we are reading this book. The reason we're reading this book is because of the book that we read before this, the worst book I've ever read. Black Love is a Revolutionary Act, and I'm still in my feelings, as they say, about that text and the listener response to it. That right there, the reason we're reading this, I said there's no way I could imagine. And in fact, I asked repeatedly. I asked online, I asked on the air repeatedly, can anybody name a book that just trashes black females, that's like scholarly, not like a scholarly text that was accepted, like people co-signed on, like, yep, that's accurate, tell it like it is, and just puts down black females exclusively. No one could name one book. Now, hey, this is open forever, as long as we're on. So if you think of one, submit it. But thus far, I didn't get any. And in fact, I didn't just get none. People submitted more books that bash black males. That's why I think he wrote that sentence specifically. I can't think of one time where a black female died under any circumstances, and that became, I'm going to stand on this black female corpse and give my gripes about black females. I can't think of one time where that has happened. That happens all the time with black males. That's why I think that sentence is specific to black males, very specific. I could be an error. Dr. Curry could be an error. I could be an error as well. We can ask. That can be one. We can put that in the notebook, Mr. Demery-Forrest question. We can ask Dr. Curry and see why he put it in that way specifically. Let's see. Other things that stood out. He wrote that from this week. He said, Dr. Curry, the experience of the black man in America seems to be one in which he is called Mr., but is treated with a niggardly regard, and the result is the positioning of black males at the lower rungs of society and their experiencing underachievement in almost all aspects of life. Now, this is actually a quote from Toby Jenkins, not Dr. Curry's direct words, but I mean, I can see why he put it in. That is a powerful quote in my view. And it kind of goes to my sentiment about, you know, I'm not in for enslaved and all. If I'm going to be treated like a nigger, I prefer that's what I be called until that has been rectified. Don't let me be confused where I'm thinking I'm somebody and I'm a nigger. And I think that that is the system of white supremacy. And I think when you're in an environment where you're treated as a nigger, but they're not, you're not being called that, you don't understand this is the system of racism, white supremacy, you can end up internalizing a lot of that and thinking that the problems that you're having are your fault, not that, oh, I'm being victimized all the time, not understanding. Let's see. Great commentary, I thought y'all had about DeUlio and the super predator commentary. And I think it's also important, too, that he retracted his sentiments. This happens on a regular basis where people are able to come out and publish theories, reports that, you know, ridicule black people or denigrate black people. And then they say, oh, man, I changed my mind on that. That was Michelle Wallace. Now, I changed, you know, my views on some of this. My bad. Maybe it wasn't these no good, shiftless, chauvinist, sexist black males who ruined the civil rights movement. My fault. That seems to be a pattern. I submit there was quite a bit of that because I think there were a lot of inaccuracies in Black Love is a Revolutionary Act. Same thing, Eric Holder, the attorney general, not just some random person on a corner, but attorney general to come out and say this. And it, whoops, got that wrong. I got bad information. My bad. Let's see. I thought it was a really important point about the high numbers of black male victims of domestic abuse. And I was reminded, I think, when the caller was talking about Tiger Woods and him being laughed at when he was being abused, and that happening to other black male victims. I think there was an incident where a black male victim, I think it was an enforcement official, sexually mistreated him. I think it might have been a black female enforcement officer, but I remember the same sort of ridicule. Like, it wasn't something like, oh man, this is terrible. This is, you know, a violent act, like police terrorism, no less. But it was, you know, giggles, you know, nothing to be outraged about. I've noted that pattern as well, which goes back to that passage Mr. Demery-Forrest asked about. Let's see. But I thought it was great also when talking about the domestic violence that he wrote it up this way. Intimate partner violence is an extension of the violence found in neglected, that C word, communities, which enters homes through the psychology and interpersonal relationships of men and women affected by economic, political, and various other environmental traumas. I am so not a fan of Bell Hooks' work. She's a black female victim of white supremacy, VGQ. She is victim. She is guaranteed to qualify to take whatever position that she wants on the system of white supremacy. But I am so not a fan of her work. I do not think it's accurate. I do not think it is helpful with regards to replacing white supremacy with justice. Striving for accuracy is important, even just reading that passage. In fact, Bell Hooks has argued that the term domestic violence should be replaced with patriarchal violence because it continually reminds the listener that violence in the home is linked to sexism and sexist thinking, to male domination. That just sounds outright illogical, sounds mild. And that's a direct quote. Direct quote from Ms. Hooks. That just sounds illogical. As I said, it's putting it mildly. I emphasize on this program, white women, perpetrators of white terrorism, violence, racism. That's one of the main problems. Why on earth would we incorporate a term? And again, do I think this is accurate? Are we saying that white women don't commit domestic violence against white men? Really? No one thinks that happens? Come on now. Much less, you know, getting to non-white people, but really? You don't think that happens at all? And I think whites are very good at promoting victims of white supremacy who share views, opinions, thoughts, write books, talks, whatever it is, that support the system of white supremacy and or spread confusion to non-white people. Whites do that all the time, have done it for years, centuries, decades. Next. I thought this was really important as well. Dr. Curry, he says, because society dehumanizes black men and boys, constructing them as invulnerable to offense, individuals recognize that there's little punishment for taking violent action against this group. I think that's really important as well. Violence is taken against black people all the time, much more so against black males. I think the police statistics bear that out. It is an astronomical disparity between the number of black males that are shot and black females. I don't think that's anything earth-shattering. The violence, how quickly the violence against black males happens, I think is extremely important, and dehumanizing them that they can't be victims because you're a savage black male. Even as a child, you're a savage black male or a savage black male to be. So you couldn't possibly be a victim. Bell Hooks was brought up. I'm actually going to take 30 seconds. I'm going to take 30 seconds to give a book club history. I did a book club when I was a resident in Atlanta. It was a book club that was, I think, exclusively black people. The first book that they read was one of Bell Hooks' projects. I read it. I did not enjoy it at all. I did not think it was constructive or helpful about racism. I went in to the book club to share my views and was immediately rebuked by a black male who told me that I was talking hogwash. And after he finished his commentary with a smile, I said, "Did you read the book?" And he said, "No." That was years before the cows existed. So, you know, if I am a little prickly sometimes when people have not read the book or are not paying attention as we read and then call in to rebuke or challenge what is being presented, there is a history around that. Got that done quickly. Back to Dr. Curry. Employing violence without fear of punishment. I think that's so important because that's demonstrated on a regular basis. You can pummel. I mean, that's why I said E.J. Bradford. I could have picked anything I wanted. E.J. Bradford today. Could have went Willie Horton. Anyway, I wanted with just things that happened in the last, 4 or 5 days, last couple hours, easily. I can't even remember all of the different shootings because they haven't even settled the one with the security guard. I don't even remember his name. He's been erased already. I don't even remember his name, the security guard. But I could have picked any one. You can do these things without fear of punishment. Doesn't matter whether he had a gun. Doesn't matter whether he's 13, 10, 12, whatever it is. Doesn't matter. Had his hands up, handcuffed, on the ground. Doesn't matter. Without fear of punishment that is demonstrated so consistently in the system of white supremacy. Black males can be anything. And fungibility, I'm glad the listener took time to look that word up. I said have a dictionary. If you really want to maximize what you can learn, extract from this text, have a dictionary. He's been using the term fungibility throughout the text, and I think it's fundamental understanding that term because he's going to continue using it, but it's fundamental. The interchangeability, if I could exchange, right, find a synonym, interchangeability. When he says fungibility, this book is called The Man Not. You're not a man. Black males. Why does Mr. Fuller, you're not a man. Black males. Black males. And specifically because of the sexual element of the terrorism, maybe it's, you know, heterosexual rape. Maybe it's homosexual rape. You're not a man. You're not even a human being. So I can do whatever I want with you. That's why I can castrate and take your genitals. That's why we can put you in prison and have you raping other inmates. Or I, as the warden, white man, can come and rape you. We talked about that on the program before repeatedly, or put hot sauce on your genitals. You're not a human being. You're not a man. The man not. I can enjoy and abuse you however I want as an interchangeable thing, fucking thing, whatever type of thing, but my thing as racist man and or racist woman. Very important, I thought. See anything else I want to make sure I get in. And if ever I'm sharing anything that does not make sense, or if you read, because frequently I try to read a passage to support what I'm sharing, if I read or I'm sharing something that does not make sense or you had a different interpretation, please speak up and share. I thought it was really important. Carolyn West, guest on this program as well. She was here with us earlier this year. We talked about her work on pornography. Thought it was great that he's quoted a lot of black authors throughout the text. Elaine Brown, former member of the Black Panther Party. But Dr. Carolyn West, her work, when she said, however, when one evaluates the rates of intimate partner violence among black, Asian, Hispanic, and indigenous men and women, few gender differences in rates of physical and psychological aggression are found. I thought that was really important because we had really strong pushback on this program before from listeners saying that they didn't think there were some of the exact things that Dr. Curry said in the book, that they didn't think there were a substantial number of black male victims of domestic abuse, and saying that that is not the case. And again, identifying that that is a result, that is a product of white supremacy, having all of that violence, stress, tension, we take it out on each other. First time, last time. Make sure I insert that, Mr. Neely Fuller Jr. First time, last time. I'll stop there. Any other thoughts, folks? Want to make sure they get in before we get to the second audio segment.
Yes, Gus.
Mr. Demerson.
First of all, yes. First of all, that phrase that we were talking about, it just leads me to believe that although black males are on the bottom rung, and that they're, you know, in every area and can be victims and all this, when it's a class thing, when the black males rise above their situation, they are the ones that are unsympathetic and not understanding those that were left behind. You know, that's all I can come up with. I may be wrong on that. But then one other thing, I was listening to a lecture Dr. Curry was doing, and you know, one of the hosts of the show, you know, was saying that in those IPVs, the interpersonal violence, that same-sex couples experience violence equal to and sometimes even more than heterosexual couples because of the stigma you know, that's associated with their lifestyle. But that's not pushed because that doesn't go along with the agenda that they're trying to get across at this time. I'll mute my line. Thanks, girl.
Grand. We will pause here so that we can go ahead and begin the second audio segment and make sure that we have ample time for folks to share additional comments. If you had something more to say, just make a note and we'll have time to share once we get done with the second audio segment. This is Dr. Tommy J. Curry, The Man Not, Context of White Supremacy, audio segment number 2.
Not wanted and not cared for, sexual abuse and the rape of young black boys. Heavily related to the environmental causes of intimate partner violence are the problems of sexual violence and the rape of black boys in our communities. The poverty, criminalization, and unwantedness of black boys combine to create staggering realities around their sexual vulnerability and invisibility. As Nikita Faustin notes, a major reason for the increasing rates of sexual abuse in black America is that young black boys are indiscriminately arrested at an early age and sent to local or state facilities where they are routinely raped or assaulted. Sexual assault, violence, and abuse occur so often in group home settings and foster homes and rehabilitative centers simply because you don't have the quality of care or the necessary supervision. This abuse is not isolated to male or female perpetrators. Black boys are at risk with both. The trepidation toward associating sexual abuse and rape with homosexuality in the black community must be engaged just as much as our cultural stigma asserting that women cannot be rapists. Black boys being penetrated and being forced to penetrate are both legally defined as rape. Black boys find themselves overrepresented and the most unwanted in foster care. Though blacks are generally less desirable than whites, black girls are twice as likely to receive an application for adoption as black boys. This unwantedness makes black boys especially vulnerable to multiple unsupervised interactions with adults and homes that increase their vulnerability to sexual abuse and rape. Despite biases that may hold that black males can't be raped or are not severely affected by rape and sexual molestation, the reality is that all abuse has very real consequences. On August 8, 2014, Melinda Gaffney, a 30-year-old black woman, shot and killed Terrence Forks, the 16-year-old father of her child. Not only was the case not widely reported, but Forks also was not thought of in any account as a victim of statutory rape or sexual assault, even though at 16 he was a minor. The young Terrence Forks is thought of only as a dead black boy, not the victim of sexual assault. Even abuse at the hands of a woman, experts say, can have a negative impact on a young black man's sexuality in adulthood, writes Faustin. Although a boy's early experimentation with a woman has often been referred to as a rite of passage, it can complicate his psychological perception of impotence if he is unable to perform. The lack of attention to and knowledge of male victims of sexual abuse and rape makes the recognition of serious mental health issues such as anxiety, depression, and antisocial behavior more difficult to recognize in black males burdened by the racist stigmas that hold them to be sociopathic entities regardless of their specific traumatic histories. The sexual assault of black boys and the ways this particular violence toward them conditions their socialization and maturation is practically non-existent within academic literature generally and is rarely mentioned with any degree of empirical certainty in Black masculinity literature. Perhaps this should come as no surprise since Shirley Salmon Davis and Larry E. Davis write, Black boys who have been sexually abused have been understudied, underreported, and underresponded to. Black boys experience sexual abuse largely in isolation. They rarely have access to professional resources or social networks that understand and can speak to the reality of male victims of sexual assault and rape. The young boys experience feelings of loss, alienation, and fear of removal by the state if the abuse is reported. The abandonment, anger, neglect, distrust, and depression are all realities for young victims of sexual violence. This is only exacerbated by the lack of other Black males in Black communities in whom young Black boys can confide. Given the high percentage of female-headed families in the African-American community, not having a reliable confidant is a reality for many African-American boys. In this sense, an African-American boy's perception of a female caretaker's failure to acknowledge this issue may contribute further to his feelings of rage and depression. Throughout Black celebrity culture, we often see Black men confessing that their first sexual experiences were, in fact, statutory rape, yet such revelations create no impetus to study or acknowledge Black male rape. Lil Wayne, for instance, maintains that he lost his virginity at 11 to a 14-year-old. Chris Brown's confession of being raped at age 8 by a much older teenager grew similar indifference. Black boys are forced to suffer the stigma and psychological trauma of rape alone. While many learn to explain it away as a rite of passage, the trauma does not simply disappear. While it is acknowledged that homosexuality and, by effect, male-on-male rape of young Black boys may be an uncomfortable topic to broach, the discussion of female perpetration of rape against Black males is engaged as an impossibility. The hyper-masculinity of the Black male brute resonates in the minds of observers and theorists as a denial of his sexual victimization and rape by women. The idea many hold is that a Black male could never be overpowered or abused by any woman. He is a little buck. He craves sex. He is the aggressor, the rapist. This overdetermined envisioning of the Black boy makes even his empirical suffering, his stories, the actual facts of the matter, imperceptible to the general public and academic audiences alike. There is a lack of shelters and services for men generally, but because of the stereotypes that view Black males as only perpetrators of domestic and sexual violence, Black men and boys are left without treatment for their trauma or amelioration of the mental anguish caused by abuse. It is this untreated and unacknowledged history of sexual trauma that manifests itself as violence against intimates later in life. Many academics not only ignore but also defend this invisibility by suggesting that focusing on male victims, specifically Black male victims of rape, takes our attention away from the realities of female rape victims. In general, the denial of Black male victimization within disciplines is thought to be necessary to the advancement of a gender progressive view of racism. This paradigm is not about progressivism toward gender, but about the aversion to studying Black men and boys throughout the humanist sciences. the documented cases of sexual coercion and abuse of Black males in the social sciences should serve as evidence for thinking about these realities anew throughout the humanist sciences. The new racism, the Black academic class, and the political economics of Black male erasure. The Condemnation of Little B, 2002, launches an attack on the academic and bourgeois economic interests of intellectuals, state officials, and politicians, following the economic analyses articulated by thinkers such as Huey P. Newton, Malcolm X, and Harold Cruz. Elaine Brown argues that 21st century development of racism built around the prison industrial complex and the sacrificing of young Black men and boys to the corporate leviathan remains ignored even in radical leftist and academic progressive movements. Brown builds her analysis from Malcolm X's account of the modernization of the slave plantation as a symbol of the slave culture and economic modes of production that have survived and modernized to accommodate the racist capitalist culture of the 21st century. X's analysis of the plantation economy in the United States made Black intellectuals as well as white liberals uncomfortable because, unlike the Marxist-Leninist left that aimed to subsume racial class division as part of the ideology of the bourgeoisie, X's analysis particularized the class aspirations and divisions within Black society as remnants of the slave culture's hold on the Black mind. Following Malcolm X's schema of white supremacy and economics in the United States, Brown argues for understanding the class hierarchies between poor working class Blacks and educated and middle class Blacks as a function of white sociopolitical organization. Blacks not only remained in the same oppressive relationship to the new industrial economic structure as under slavery, but also remained trapped in the same inferior role in the social and cultural scheme under American apartheid. Now, the field slaves were the Black masses, sharecropping or cleaning the factories of an urbanized America, cordoned off in their southern shanty towns or new northern ghettos. The house slave now owned a funeral home or barber shop or catering business, or, having miraculously managed an education at one of the land grant or turn of the century colleges built for Blacks, was a teacher, a doctor, a lawyer, mostly attending other Blacks. Though he was, like the post-emancipation field slave, suffering under social segregation and discrimination, the industrial house slave often harbored the mentality of the old house slave, particularly in fear and hatred of the field slave and obsequiousness toward the master. The racial progress the Black race has enjoyed after the civil rights era is merely symbolic. The legislation and opportunities offered to Black people did not extend down to the bottom. In fact, in Brown's view, the economic mobility and opportunities for education offered to Blacks ultimately splintered the Black community more sharply, placing working class Black folk, the poor urban folk, outside the purview of racial achievement, allowing more powerful Blacks to legitimate the racist stereotypes of the lower classes without remorse. Brown argues, too many Blacks who had come to occupy places of power in the American scheme, no matter how limited, no matter how vicarious, were beginning to feel no obligation to align themselves with the struggle of the Black masses, were doing nothing for the Black community and doing nothing with impunity, were doing nothing to use their limited power to elevate the race. Now they seemed to rise guiltless above the underclass, even renouncing their ties to the Black underclass. unlike those whose schemas simply want to identify anti-blackness in the asymmetries between white life and black life throughout the various concentric spheres of American society, Woodson, Frazier, and W.E.B. Du Bois assert that attention must be called to the categories, means, views of study. Within these various planes of social existence, the various ideological foundations of life and death, be it as subject or object, as worker or owner, as man or woman, or as citizen or criminal, blackness, or more appropriately perhaps, anti-blackness, functions as the origin of these dynamics. The black bourgeoisie is not proof of the Marxist logic that holds class to be the superseding principle determining the racial. Rather, the black intellectual class is a political manifestation of the power anti-blackness holds on the minds and lives of blacks escaping death, so that even with economic mobility and relatively little power, the black elite, the black subject, the black desiring to be citizen, runs, flees from the ontology of being the nigger, the sanctioned beast, the super predator magnetized toward death. This is the foundation of 21st century racism, the new racism described by Brown as focusing on the death and dying of young black men and boys. The new racism that Brown refers to places anti-blackness within the changing political economy of America as deliberately growing empire. Brown contends that with America's new economic shift to a base of high-speed technological production, America's new masters have fashioned a new domestic social Darwinist agenda justifying the continued exploitation of the poor, especially those eternally poor, black masses. In this dichotomous strive for survival, the New Age racist seeks to forge blackness into a viable market by forcing those millions of ghettoized blacks back to their natural role as cheap labor so as to supply them with an income in order to build up the black consumer market. The New Age house slave, the black bourgeois, anyone who has elevated to the house on the back of black struggle, finds his significance in his ability and willingness to serve the New Age racist agenda. His very livelihood is dependent on his willingness to do even more than his historical counterpart. This political, cultural economy of anti-black currency, rooted in the distancing of the black bourgeoisie from the poor urban black folk, is a neoliberalist calculus, the homo economicus, choosing freedom from the burden of having the darkest soul, the material poverty of those niggers. Even though such an act commits the lower classes of black people to be the cheap labor of the white supremacist society through the eradication of the freedoms gained through civil rights, condemning black males to corporate imprisonment and, ultimately, physical death. This is the negrophobia of the black intellectual class, the phobia of being the corpse, the example, the overproduced in the eyes of the societal managerial structure. This critique was previously raised at the beginning of the 1960s. Reacting to the seemingly unmovable racist organization of America and the fixed class stratification of the black working class, Du Bois argued that a class structure began to arise within the Negro group which produced haves and have-nots, and tended to encourage more successful Negroes to join the forces of monopoly and exploitation and help victimize their own lower classes. As with the analysis offered by Frazier's Failure of the Negro Intellectual, which originally appeared in Black World in 1962, 2 years after Du Bois' Socialism and the American Negro, Dubois saw the splintering off of a black racial class that saw themselves as intermediaries between the black working folk and the white power structure. This socialization at both the level of pure economic interest and, as Frazier points out, in the ideas deployed in studying the black working class, create inaccuracies and lack of interest in improving the actual conditions of most black people. Frazier warned that the class of our intellectuals and the originators of the theories we use to understand the black masses think very much the same as white Americans, even concerning Negroes. Frazier accuses this class of mistaking the economic interest they have in maintaining their social position as the desirable economic arrangement despite the suffering, poverty, and death occurring within the masses of black folk. In refusing to start with the colonial situation and slavery and preferring instead to urge moral calls for equality, ensuring the superficial aspects of the material standard of living among Negroes and the extent to which they enjoy civil rights, the black intellectual is remiss in his grasp of the condition and fate of American Negroes. This is a problem of disciplinary knowledge. How we come to know, continue to study, and normatively suggest the end for black folk as objects, pieces of our visions as black academics, intellectuals. The black male, that violent, dirty nigger, that criminal is thought to be the source of black poverty and criminality. The black intellectual does not see the condition of black men as capable of being remedied or vindicated through sociological study and social reform. The black male is thought simply to be impervious to cultivation, and, as Brown suggests in her analysis of the super predator myth, deserving of death, incarceration, and ostracism. The erasure of black men and boys from thought is ultimately a methodological problem of how we come to know of the black male and how we think the nigger. From boys to men, the need to study black men and boys beyond the confines of black masculinity. Far too often, black men and boys are recognized only as summaries of raw sociological data, idle, collateral, figureless subjects vacated in person and defined by number. These black males are thought to be little more than the numbers indicating that black males are social problems, on the street, inevitably dead, or permanently locked away. Black males are not imagined as living human beings. They are merely thought to be particular expressions of group phenomena, individual examples of a problem population that are the criminals, deviants, and dangers that plague society. Their lives are not seen because death is normal for them. He is, they are, disposable. The black male who escapes death but is held within the prison is no more visible. Because we do not understand the actual realities of black males, we conceptualize them as they are imagined, ruled by stereotypes masquerading as theory, and remain trapped by the narratives of black males as problems. Instead of being viewers invested in the complexities of black male life, theorists embrace the racist caricatures of black men as concepts. Consequently, black males are written into gender theory as the dangers the academic theorists fear, the stereotypes by which black men and boys are represented within society. Anti-black racism, the urban landscape that is its architecture, and the brutality of the police state all operate to confine black men to poverty and various cycles of abuse and death. It is often thought that the academic scholar, the theorist, rises above the sociological realities, such as poverty, death, and criminality that surround the black male. Far too often, scholars studying black males ignore the extent to which these social phenomena are made synonymous with the very concept of black men and boys and are subsequently also internalized in the mind of the theorist. Our current theorization of black males mirrors this social reality instead of challenging it. Even in theory, black males become the origins of social problems rather than victims of them. Ontologically, black men are made synonymous with social evil. Sociologically, they are conceptualized as simply expressing this nature through deviance. Current theory only perpetuates this absence of black men in thought. Their representation as problems and dangers deserving of death, incapable of the complexities given by life, lies behind our present descriptions of them as violent patriarchs set on domination and self-destruction. Black males desperately need new ideas to account for the violence, economic, political, and industrial, that turns black men and boys into corpses. Currently, black maleness is conceptually confined by its social result, black death, rather than life, sociality. These patterns of perception of collapsing death into the undesirability of thinking about the black male sustain the disciplinary disposition toward black men generally and show little possibility that these people, humans, lives can be thought of in the minds of most as more than the cessation of their existence. For young black boys, maleness in a white supremacist society is fraught with difficulty and the all too likely outcome of death. Even when they become men, this racialized masculinity is not thought to result in a recognizable intellectual maturity and social standing of a citizen. Rather, the masculinity imposed on these black male bodies is known only through its uncontrollable excess, its lack of maturation, where any and all transgressions, no matter how small or idiosyncratic, are understood to be demonstrations of the more primitive and uncivilized aspects of a not yet evolved savagery. Black males are deprived of ontogeny. They are seen as they will forever be. As Jeffrey Canada, president of the Harlem Children's Zone, remarks concerning black boys, "The image of the male as strong is mixed with the image of male as violent. Male as viral gets confused with male as promiscuous. Male as adventurous equals male as reckless. Male as intelligent often gets mixed with male as arrogant, racist, and sexist. Boys find themselves pulled and tugged by forces beyond their control as they make the confusing and sometimes perilous trip to manhood. The milieu from which manhood springs is saturated with racist caricatures that all seem to legitimate the fear Americans have of black men. The images and perception of black men as dangerous to society, women, and themselves ultimately creates a pattern of thinking that allows the seeming inevitability of death for the young black male to be justified. If one truly wishes to understand the relationships between anti-black racism and black male sexuality, black manhood cannot continue to be understood by its lack or the extent to which the racism imposed on the lives of black men and boys simply prevents them from being capable of structurally asserting and emulating the ideal of white male patriarchy. In reality, the effect of anti-blackness on black males is epistemic in that it denatures how black manhood is seen. Anti-blackness creates a schema of social terror that substitutes the deviancy white males occupy in society, their pathology, as the nature of black males. A more correct analysis of black manhood must focus on the vulnerability of the black male, not the decontextualized assertion that his biological sex equals power, privilege, or a lust for domination. An understanding of racism and chauvinism shows that the oppression of the black male, his barring from work, his incarceration, and death is rooted in an imposition of a deadly masculine caricature, a barbarism that justifies multiple genocidal logics and encourages racist misandry or hatred of black men throughout this society and the disciplines birthed from it. The black male is not born a patriarchal male. He is raced and sexed peculiarly, configured as a barbaric and savage, imagined to be a violent animal, not a human being. His mere existence ignites the negrophobia, taken to be the agreed-on justification for his death. This fear, or cultural intuition expressed toward black males, calls on this society to support the imposition of death on those bodies and offer consent for the rationalizations the police state presents to the public as its justification for killing the black beast, the rapist, the criminal, and the thug. The young black male's death, the death of black boys, is merely an extension of this logic. The need to destroy the black beast cub before it matures into full pathology. The black boy, that child, is seen as the potential to be the nigger beast. This anti-black dynamic that specifically affects the black boy has been referred to by Elaine Brown as a new kind of racism, a racism built on the anti-black mythology of America's black males as super predators. The super predator mythology not only acts to legitimize the violence responsible for the deaths of black males, but also inculcates the rationalization that, given what black males actually are, black male death is necessary and an indispensable strategy for the safety and security of American society. Overlooking the genocidal disposition of America toward black males presents an incomplete diagnosis of the impetus behind the levels of violence and sanctions imposed on black communities, black women, black families, in an effort to control the lives of young black males. The stigma of criminality plagues black males throughout their lives and specifically affects their ability to obtain work. This active discrimination confines black men, those with criminal records as well as those without criminal offenses, to poverty and economic insecurity. Throughout liberal arts, disciplines which tend to prioritize experience and positionality over sociological data and empiricism, it is common practice to point selectively to wage disparity between black men and women or appeal to the idea of black male privilege to de-emphasize the consequences of black male unemployment and disadvantage. In stark contrast to our academic configurations of race, class, and gender, various sociological studies show that black males are more economically disadvantaged than other groups. This knowledge should inspire scholars to study the conditions and the effects of those conditions on the larger communities to which these black men belong, rather than retreat into identity politics. The exclusion of black men from the gender category results in a singular analysis that confines all of their disadvantages to racism. Because racism is shared not only by their female counterparts, but also by various ethnic and religious groups that have become racialized, black males' oppression is thought of as a general phenomenon common to all disadvantaged populations. No racialized group is more criminalized, killed by homicide, or isolated from society as black males. This is readily apparent when one surveys the empirical evidence on mortality, unemployment, incarceration, and education. However, in liberal arts disciplines, such evidence is not enough, as empirical work is disregarded in favor of ideology and rarely has an effect on theory. Context of white supremacy, and that is where we will begin next week. We did not quite get all the way to the end of chapter 3. It's a little lengthy. I wanted to make sure that we had time to share, so we will finish off chapter 3 next week and then get to chapter 4. But we are roughly halfway to the conclusion of The Man Knot. Number again, 641-715-3640, the code 564-943, pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. If you did not get to share during the first segment, you should definitely get a hand up now. Don't lollygag. If you have comments, questions, thoughts, go ahead and speak up. We have about 30 minutes before the conclusion of the broadcast. Nothing stood out for folks. Second audio segment. No questions, no thoughts.
Yes, Matthew.
Mr. Demery Four.
Okay. The part that I highlighted. Oh, on page 125, there's a lack of shelters and services for men generally, but because of the stereotypes that view black males only as perpetrators of domestic and sexual violence, black men and boys are left without treatment for their trauma or ameliorations of mental anguish caused by abuse. You know, that is a very serious social problem. You know, I can remember years ago when I was a young man, and you know, I fell into hard times. I had to, you know, apply for some assistance or whatever. It's comical because all they gave me was like $100 a month, and I think I got it a couple months. As soon as I got a job, do you know that the social services billed me for that $200. I had to repay that $200. It's really pathetic, the services that is available for black men and boys. It's almost like, you know, society itself has turned its back on you. And, but expect you to somehow succeed in a society that is hell-bent on your extermination. Augustine, I hear you say that Elaine Brown was a, did she came on the show at one time?
No, sir. I said that she was a former member of the Black Panther Party. Carolyn West was a guest on the program this year. That's who I was talking about, Dr. Carolyn West.
Okay. All right. Thank you for clearing that up. You know, I really like what Miss Elaine Brown is talking about. The New Age racist seeks, 128, the New Age racist seeks to forge blacks into a viable market by forcing those millions of ghettoized blacks back to their natural role as cheap labor so as to supply them with an income in order to build up the black consumer market cell phones and the like. The new age house slave, the black bourgeois, anyone who has elevated to the house on the back of black struggle finds his significance in his ability and willingness to serve the new age racist agenda. His very likelihood is dependent on his willingness to do even more than his historical counterparts. I mean, you can't hardly write a book like this without, you know, calling it what it is. And when you do, we still are going to come out. You know, everything is against us, and then we ourselves turn against our own self. I'll mute my line, Gus. Thanks.
Much obliged, Mr. Demery Four. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have comments, questions, thoughts you'd like to share, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Retired firefighter, yes, sir.
Yes, I thought it was accurate and interesting about the report that was given about the adoption and on how difficult it is when it comes to black males, the least to get connected with a caring a care group, and in turn would spend their entire quote unquote childhood or youth years with the quote unquote system of that particular state. It would be a black male. Ironically speaking, that movie that Denzel Washington played in, I can't think of the name of it now, has been airing lately. I just can't think of it, about the very subject. I just can't think of the name of the movie. Yeah, yeah. It's been airing lately on whatever movie channels that they have on television. Yeah, I thought it was pretty interesting and accurate because it just chimes right in with the global system of racist white supremacy. Unfortunately, that's why I think it's accurate. I enjoyed Miss Brown's commentary, and I thought I kept hearing a name, and I kept associating with the name with the person who was a member of the Black Panther Party and rose in status in the Black Panther Party to the end of the Black Panther Party. And that's exactly who it was. Ironically, she was involved in a tragic episode at UCLA campus that involved the murder of two black males, Mr. Huggins and Mr. Carter. Yeah, those are some observations from the second reading. Thank you.
Much obliged, retired firefighter. I was not going to bring it, or I was undecided about whether I was going to say anything about it or not. But since retired firefighter commented on it, Elaine Brown was accused of being a quote-unquote agent during her affiliation with the Black Panther Party. That's in a few, you'd have to go back and dig. Racial Matters, Dr. Kenneth O'Reilly, that might be one. All Power to the People documentary, that's two sources you can investigate. That's not really, well, anyway. Other folks who dialed in, if you have commentary.
Can I be heard?
Retired by Thomas in New York, yes, sir.
Yes, Yeah, I agree with Brown. I liked her commentary.
Also, I think it was Frazier he was quoting from. I agree with a lot of that commentary as well. Yeah, I thought that they were right on point with and one of the things that we can't hold other black people accountable. We don't have the power to. So we often start blaming, you know, the entertainer or this person or that person who's getting some crumbs off the table, as opposed to realizing that, you know, we shouldn't have depended on them in the first place. We have a system of white supremacy. So I thought that that was right on point. And I'll mute my line for now. Thank you.
For now, he says, for now. Other folks who have comments they would like to share? Everyone satisfied for the moment? Can get to my notes if folks need time. I'll go ahead and go through some of my notes and then check again, see if other folks have commentary. Let's see. Oh, yeah, the adoption statistics I thought were really important as well, because it not just once you get larger, but even before I get to that, it says black boys are at risk. Oh, he's talking about how the sexual abuse of black boys starts because of the incarceration, which is what I was going back saying before, the threat that black males, I think that it's exclusive to black males in terms of representing a violent threat where you need to be violently suppressed, caged, removed, that seems much more intensely focused on black males. Not that it doesn't happen to black females, but even young black children, where he says, as a result of this, all the sexual abuse that happens in the foster homes and juvenile detention centers and such, he said this abuse is not isolated to male or female perpetrators. Black boys are at risk with both. The trepidation toward associating sexual abuse and rape with homosexuality in the black community must be engaged just as much as our cultural stigma asserting that women cannot be rapists. Black boys being penetrated and being forced to penetrate are both legally defined as rape. Is there trepidation toward associating sexual abuse and rape with homosexuality in the quote-unquote black community? Question. I'll share a few more notes, but folks can think about that. Is there trepidation, a fear or unwillingness, a hesitancy toward associating sexual abuse and rape with homosexuality in the quote-unquote black community? Do you all think that's true? I'll come back for a response later. The adoption statistics, I thought that was really important as well. Blacks are generally less desirable than whites. Black girls are twice as likely to receive an application for adoption as black boys. This unwantedness makes black boys especially vulnerable to multiple unsupervised interactions with adults. And as someone who used to work in the foster care system, ick, man, that is horrible all the way around. Let's see. The lack of shelters and services. I remember I used to live in, get to mention Atlanta again. I lived in Atlanta. They have a lot of black males, a lot of black people, period, but a lot of black males that live in Atlanta. And they have a lot of poor, down and out black males in Atlanta, huge numbers. And one of our listeners, she did services. It was like rehabilitation counseling and such. And she was talking about how it's more difficult to get services for black males. I saw that myself, seems to be a pattern. And exactly to what he said, there's a lack of shelters and services for men generally, but because of the stereotypes that view black males as only perpetrators of domestic and sexual violence, black men and boys are left without treatment for their trauma or amelioration of the mental anguish caused by abuse. I thought that was really important. Even the black male, I think Terry Crews is his name, big guy, muscles, looks like he, you know, 250, 300 pounds, really big guy. But he talked about being groped. White guy, same thing. Thomas in New York said, white guy came up and grabbed his
genitals. Some, you know, suspected racist in Hollywood, as they say, but he talked about it, and it was the same type of thing. People said, "Oh my gosh, you're a big, huge guy. You should have, you know, took your pinky and, you know, knocked him out," or whatever the case. Where it was not that sympathy that I talked about from that passage before. Let's see. Elaine Brown is a victim of white supremacy as well, but I was not exactly thrilled with her sentiment. And really, I can quote Thomas in New York, what he said: we cannot, black people, other victims, we cannot hold other non-white people, victims of racism, accountable for how they respond to racism. So once you ascertain that that is true, what good does it do to sit around and, you know, fault find with how other victims are responding, with whether they agree with white people, they don't agree with white people, they're talking bad about black males, they're not talking bad about black males? What does it matter? You just go about solving the problem, especially if you understand why they are doing these things. There's a system of racism, white supremacy. Whites can apply a lot of power directly, indirectly. You understand that? I don't understand why the frustration or focus on how these other victims are responding. And specifically, some of the things where he quotes her, and he says, or she says, him quoting her, that in Brown's view, the economic mobility and opportunities for education offered to blacks ultimately splintered the poor urban folk outside of the purview of racial achievement. I would even pause right there, because there's so many statistics that have said black people are in the same place economically that we were in 50 years ago. So if that's true, how could there be a splintering if we've not made any economic process? We're in the same spot we were in. That would be one. Next, allowing more powerful blacks, whatever that means, to legitimate the racist stereotypes of the lower classes without remorse. That's a big one. I don't know what that means, to legitimate the racist stereotypes of the lower classes without remorse, in a system of white supremacy. How would a non-white person, quote unquote, legitimate anything that racists are doing, saying, not doing? I don't even know what that means, in a system of racism, white supremacy, and without remorse. So if they're doing these things, and I don't even know how you would ascertain that. Did you go around and ask them, do you feel remorseful about your conduct? I don't even know how you would ascertain that. And this is all a direct quote from Elaine Brown. Too many blacks who had come to occupy places of power. There's that word again. What does that mean? In the American scheme, no matter how limited, no matter how vicarious, were beginning to feel no obligation to align themselves with the struggle of the black masses. Pause again. Unless I've been misinformed, most black people did not feel aligned to the quote-unquote black masses during the civil rights movement. That's what I heard repeatedly, that most black people, were most black people aligned with the Black Panther Party? Absolutely not. Were most black people aligned with Malcolm X? Absolutely not. Now, they can talk all that romanticizing now, but during the time, no. The same way now, most black people, they are not aligned with Dr. Welsing, Gus T. Renegade, the Cows, Khalid Muhammad, Dr. Cambon, pick the black person. Bell Hook, most black people are not aligned with Bell Hooks or Elaine Brown either. That's the system of racism, white supremacy. Continuing. These limited black people who were in power, allegedly, were doing nothing for the black community. There's that word again. And doing nothing with impunity. Now, that to me suggests that there is some sort of drop squad of black people that can go out and, you know, do some shakedowns and, hey, we see you. You're not doing right. You're not aligned with the black masses. You know, we're going to, you know, toilet paper your house or key your car, or put you in the headlock or whatever, you know, whatever they're going to do to make you get your act together. What world is that? Did they have that in the Black Panther Party? I thought that led to some of the problems that they were talking about. That doesn't sound constructive to me, and it doesn't sound enforceable. That sounds like something where you might have to answer to whites for, you know, getting other niggers in check for their conduct. Continuing, these black people were doing nothing to use their limited power. There's a lot of use of the word power here. If we're talking about black people, we're talking about people who do not have very much power at all. And I'm going to stop there.
Because, yeah, before you all had even said anything about Elaine Brown, I had already highlighted. I'm not having to do anything special because I'd already highlighted, like, wow, this sounds like someone who might be a little bit confused. And just in general, anytime the focus starts to go to other Black people and I'm dissatisfied with how other Black people are responding to racism, white supremacy, my general tendency is to think we might be heading in a non-constructive direction. I'm generally very unfocused on how other Black people are responding, particularly if it's I'm dissatisfied with how other Black people are responding to racism, white supremacy. Continuing. The Black, he mentions E. Franklin Frazier, who I am also very familiar with. E. Franklin Frazier, in addition to writing The Failure of the Negro Intellectual, a book that I have not completed, but I have read some of it. It is a big book. Way too big for us to ever read on the book club. He also wrote Black Bourgeoisie, which is pretty good, short enough we could read on the book club. It's pretty nice. But yeah, y'all can read that on your own. He wrote quite a few things. In fact, E. Franklin Frazier is the reason I say write poorly. He is a sociologist. He did work for years. He died before Minister Malcolm X in the 1960s. But in the 1920s, he did a report. It was exclusively on Black males. Jesus, I'm going to have to go back and find it. He did this report. It's like 1929. He went in the South and he was interviewing Black people. He was focused on Black males, and he said there was a tendency, if you asked Black males how they were doing, they would say right poorly. And he said if you did an investigation, right, to see if there was anything wrong with them, they would have no physical ailment or what have you. But because they were in such a, you know, pitiful position, system of white supremacy, they had just gotten accustomed to saying right poorly when asked how they were, which is accurate, which is told. But he had this really long write-up about this. I will have to go back and find the report. But that E. Franklin Frazier is why I say write poorly, a report that he wrote almost 100 years ago. Anyway, all of that to say, so he's caught about E. Franklin Frazier's Failure of the Negro Intellectual, which initially appeared in Black World before it became the book that I referenced. Black World was Negro Digest, great piece of literature if you want to go back and check it out. They have a lot of they have writings on Malcolm X and the whole what they call civil rights movement. Great piece of work if you want to go back and do some studying. I'll stop there. Did other folks have commentary that they wanted to share? Anything before we wrap things up? Yes, sir. Hang on 1 second. We had someone who hasn't shared it all. I'll make sure we get you as well, Thomas in New York. Irie, did you have commentary from Louisiana?
Yes. Hello, Gus, and hello, everybody else. I wanted to say, yes, I think there is trepidation on admitting the homosexuality with young Black men, young Black males, because there's a lot of trepidation in admitting that they're predated in the first place. And, you know, the stigma of homosexuality, a lot of people are ready to engage Black men who show the signs of, you know, being effeminate and everything, but when it comes to Black men that don't showcase homosexuality or victimization, you know, by being girly or, you know, showing, you know, I can't really phrase it right now, but yes, I do think there is trepidation. Would you repeat what she said about the she said well-to-do Black people did something, they legitimize stereotype? Is that what she said?
Let's see. Try to be precise. I can give you the exact quote. Okay. In Brown's view, the economic mobility and opportunities for education offered to Blacks ultimately splintered the Black community more sharply, placing working class Black folk, the poor urban folk, outside the purview of racial achievement, allowing more powerful Blacks to legitimate
the racist stereotypes of the lower classes without remorse.
Okay, so I am not going to put words in her mouth, but from my understanding and logic on my behalf, I think maybe she could be talking about non-white black people that do become well-to-do, wealthy, or in the spotlight, like more so celebrity. For instance, there was an interview I saw with, shamefully I say this, Lil Wayne, where obviously he's wealthy. Obviously he has, he's in the spotlight. And he was interviewed and he was asked about Black Lives Matter and racism. He was like, how could there be racism? Like, everybody loves me. White people listen to me. There can't be any such thing as racism. And at that particular point, he did epitomize every stereotype I could think of and anyone else could think of, you know, because of his answer, his demeanor, his dress, and the music he produces. So perhaps that's one way it could be taken. And that's what I was going to say to that point. Thank you, everyone. I'll mute my line. Have a good night.
For sure. I don't know if Lil Wayne qualifies as powerful or even more powerful. If I have a list of more powerful blacks, in quotes, and Lil Wayne is on that list, that is all I need to know about Black Power 2019. Other folks?
Can I be heard?
Retired firefighter.
I would equate some of my last comments with not having the book and also just plain old mental retardation on some of the things that I missed on about what Miss Brown was talking on, specifically from the rhetoric from the Black Panther Party was known for with things such as class. Mr. Fuller said years ago is that there's only two classes, powerful and powerless. And no matter how much income a non-white black person has, they feel in that powerless class. Example, Mr. William Cosby, with his millions of dollars, I'm pretty sure that he is in a cell next to or sitting across the table from a non-white person who doesn't have a whole lot of money and fortune. So that money that he has really doesn't mean anything at this point in time, and or something that is mistaken as being powerful, you know, at the same time. So they kind of like puts a blemish on that understanding. But I would still say VGQ if she thinks otherwise. But yeah, that's the only thing I can think of right now. Thank you.
Thomason, right on time.
Yes, sir. I just wanted to add more context and clarity to what I said earlier, but I think for blacks, to blame blacks for doing nothing is a waste of time. However, it's important to point out the blacks who are working against the best interest of black masses, not to blame them, but to find out the white people who they're working for in the agenda. Sometimes those people who stay unrevealed until, you know, you see the agenda that they're pushing through another black person, and you could point out the white people behind them. Is it trepidation? I think it's yes, and it's also negligence. But it's obvious that there's a connection between the sexual assault and rape of young black males and the homosexuality. Now, at the hospital, I saw things done to children, wouldn't imagine when they came into the emergency room. I was shocked at the amount of male-on-male sexual abuse done to children. It's generally associate that with little girls being molested, but it was so many boys. It was almost equal, 50-50. And when it was a black male, the empathy left amongst the staff, the nurses, everyone. It didn't care like they did when it was a little black girl. When the police got there and they, ACS calls them to make an arrest or someone who did it, the state of urgency, was, they come in joking, it's not taken serious. But when it was a little girl, they were very serious, very engaged. I noticed a big difference. And also, when males were coming from the prison who had been sexually assaulted, no one cared. It was like, just a procedure. And that's all I wanted to say. Thank you.
Much obliged, Thomas in New York. Any other folks have commentary they wanted to share, or particularly folks wanted to answer the question about trepidation, about acknowledging homosexuality and sexual abuse of black children, black boys? Going once. We will call that a broadcast. I'm going to ask about that on the compensatory call-in this weekend, because I'd be curious to know more about that. I'll ask if folks, if you listen to the archive and you want to email a response, untiljustice@gmail.com, let me know your thoughts. I can read next week when we pick up. We'll finish the rest of Chapter 3. Much obliged to all the folks who dialed in to share their views. Hopefully a constructive investment of your Thursday evening. We'll be here tomorrow, Neutralizing Workplace Racism, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, and Saturday, Compensatory Call-In, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. Again, sobriety would be best under conditions of white terrorism. Let's keep our brain computer working efficiently so that we can solve problems, the problem, as soon as possible. In addition to being sober, let's be buckled up each and every time we are in a vehicle, driver, or passenger. Let's do all that we can to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no. That's it. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Kyle signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, brother.
No problem. You're a victim.
Man, I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.